Bible and open with me to the book of Mark, where we're continuing a study there, and we're going to do that for this week and the next couple of weeks. Then we'll be doing on the 20th one Christmas service and emphasis as well as on the 24th, but we're going to continue our series in Mark until then. And today you find us at Mark chapter 10, and if you didn't bring a Bible, there are chair Bibles for you to grab, and that is found on page 707. I'd like you to open with me to Mark chapter 10. We're beginning at verse 32. Mark chapter 10, verse 32. They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took 12 aside, and he told them what was going to happen to him. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit on your right hand and the other sit on your left in your glory." "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left hand is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me!" Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet. But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me!" Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," Jesus said, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and he followed Jesus along the road. The Word of God. This is the fourth time that Jesus has told the disciples that he's going into the city to die. He's going to the cross. When we think about that, and when many people look at this whole idea of a basic understanding of what Christianity is, and we talk about blood and we put it in a picture or we put up a cross and we talk about what the cross means, we find that they say, "What's with all the blood? What's with the violence? Why is Christianity about that kind of stuff? Why so many focuses on that? I mean, why do religions focus on that?" I mean, if you go back to old Greek religions, you find also that, for instance, in the Iliad, Homer wrote that Agamemnon, he couldn't get fair winds to sail to Troy until he sacrificed his daughter. So, is the crucifixion just one more evidence of a bloody God who wants all these bloody sacrifices? That's the way people look at what is going on and wonder why we look at and amplify a cross and talk about blood. How can a loving God arrange for the death of his son? His death, we find though, and the truth is, that his death is not because God is a cruel God, but because he is a loving God. But we have to dig into it to be able to see that that's what it's really about. Now, maybe you don't really believe that. Maybe you're here today and you're saying, I really don't understand. Why is it that God would kill his son? And you've wrestled with that. Well, let me explain a personal example that might help us. My dad is 89 years old, and he's in reasonably good health. He still drives his own car. He lives by himself. He pretty much completely takes care of himself, other than like dealing with lots of paperwork and that kind of stuff. He can't do that, but he pretty much takes care of himself, and he's a real baseball fan, and such is that he actually predicted who is going to win the World Series. He's that much of a baseball fan. He gets it. He knows it. But last week, he went over to my sister's for lunch, and he gave me the update that my sister, who's just 2 years older than me, has such advanced Alzheimer's disease that she put tea on the counter that she was making. She reached up and she grabbed the sugar from the cupboard, which she had to be told where it was at, though she used to be a cake baker in her home and was that much of a kitchen person. And she took the sugar back down, and she couldn't remember why she got the sugar out of the cupboard, though the tea was sitting right there. And my dad has said over and over again, I wish I could take that and put it on me instead of being on her so young. Is that normal? Is that natural that a parent would want that, to be able to take that on for their child? Of course it is. Then why not the cross? See, if we can understand that kind of sacrifice on the part of a parent, why can't we understand a parent in heaven who would use a cross to be able to move and work in us? So if we could grant that wish for my father, that it would switch, we would understand that willing sacrifice more. Have you stepped back for a minute and really thought about what the idea of love really is? Have you been able to try and think through and figure out if you could love without being self-sacrificing? Is there a way, really, to love without being self-sacrificing? I mean, think about it. Here's an illustration. Have you ever met someone who decided, and it tends to be younger people, I think, who do this, but young people who decide they want to have a baby because then they'll have some really great stuff to be able to get. I mean, those babies, they're so cute and they're so fun. It'll really fulfill my life. How does that go? Having a baby to get is a bad idea, because all they require, right, is giving, is self-sacrifice giving. And when we find parents who don't go into it that way, it produces tragic results. So we find that all the time, and we see it over and over again. You've engaged with an emotionally damaged and hurting person, whether that's for a long time that they've been in that state or a short time. And when you do and you come to engage them, you find that they're not going to be able to get out of that place unless someone comes and loves them and cares for them and helps them beyond that place. All life-changing love, then, is self-sacrificing. All life-changing love is self-sacrificing. And so we find that the Christian worldview explains that God created this world, and it was beautiful, it was majestic, we sang about that, but it is corrupted by a fallen human beings who not only corrupted their own inner hearts, but the whole of the world. And so what we find is there's this incredible brokenness around the world. Now, if your worldview doesn't look at that and doesn't really agree with that, that's fine. But how else do you explain in your worldview then the pervasiveness of evil all around the world? See, that does explain it. It shows us why we see the corruptness so deep in the human heart and all around the world. And so there's this necessity of fixing it. And the fix is a recreation, if you will, a payment sufficient to buy things back from that corrupt position. And that payment was horrendous. It was the cross. The creation, beautiful, but then corrupted. so corrupted that it needed a huge payment in order to be purchased back, and that payment was found on the cross. That's the fix. That's the buyback. And so, yeah, we look at that and we say, how does that come about? And you might be asking, okay, but we just read this story, Gary. What does that have to do with me? What does that have to do with this story? I'm so glad you asked that, and you're wondering where I'm going with this. You see, because the plan was never meant to be a one-time deal. That cross is not meant to be a one-time expression. It's not meant to be that. It's not supposed to be only then. It's supposed to be about you and me and a cross. So let's look at that, and let's see here in this text, why serve, how serve, and what's the point of serving? Why do we serve? How do we serve? And what's the point of serving? So first, why serve? I want you to jump down to verse 45. Notice what it says. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. There's a key word there. What's the word? Because I just set it up for you. What's the key word in that verse? Why serve? What's the key word about serving here that Jesus is doing? Because a ransom is necessary. You're held captive. You are in chains. And unless he ransoms you out of the prison, out of the jail, out of the corruption of your own heart, we won't be set free. And he says, so I must be that ransom. Now, he's going up to the city, and he's telling them that he's going to die. It's interesting. Verses 33 and 34, he gives us seven specifics about how he's going to die. Now, think about that. He's walking into the city, and he's telling them exactly how he's going to die. Look at that. He says he's going to be delivered to the chief priests. He's going to be condemned by them. He's going to then be handed over to the Gentiles. They're going to mock him. They're going to spit on him. They're going to flog him, and they're going to kill him. Seven things exactly as to how it's going to happen. How do you do that? I like reading espionage novels, and if you have the guy who's the hero, and he goes walking into a political firestorm, now catch that it is a political firestorm, because notice what it says in verse 32. What are the people sensing is going on here as they march up toward Jerusalem? What's the people's response to him going to Jerusalem? They're afraid. They can feel the crackling of the electricity, of the clash of two kingdoms coming together. There is the kingdom that Jesus is coming into the city with, and there's the kingdoms of the rulers of the earth that are there in Jerusalem, and they're about to collide, and they know it. But they think it's going to look different than what Jesus is saying it's going to look like. He's saying, they're thinking he's going to go in and rule and reign. He's saying, I'm going to go in and die. And that's the way the clash is going to look. Now, how can someone know exactly the way they're going to die? I mean, if that happened in a novel, I would say, I'm not going to read this author. They're unrealistic. They don't know what they're doing. I mean, there's no way that this guy's going to walk in and say, yep, I'm going to get killed. And here's exactly how it's going to happen. You can't know that unless you're God. And that's exactly what he was doing. So why? To pay my ransom. That's why he served. That's why he served. Because I'm in chains. And he paid my ransom for me. But still, we haven't answered the question of me, about me serving, right? So let's go on to point two. How do we serve? So he tells them he's going to go in and die. It's going to be pretty miserable. He tells them all the specifics about how he's going to die. And the next thing they do is they get very empathetic and they say, I'm sorry, Jesus. That's going to be so hard for you. And boy, the disciples come around and give a group hug and they care for him and all that kind of stuff. That's what they do, right? What did they do? What did the disciples do? They start lobbying for who gets to be on the left and the right. Who gets to be in the best position? This is just amazing. Look at verses 35 and 37. James and John come and ask for the left and right hand man's status there. And Jesus says to them, you don't know what you're asking for. Oh, sure we do. Now, if you had some guy say that to you, and you were Jesus, what would you... Well, if you were Jesus, you wouldn't think about this, right? You would say what he said. But what I would say is very different than what Jesus said, right? I mean, can you imagine? He's just told them he's going to die, and they're lobbying for power. They're looking for selfish position. Jesus reacts so graciously. But not the other 10. Look at verse 41. They're indignant. Now, why are they indignant? Come on, you know why they're indignant. Because you didn't think of it first. I hate it when they beat me to the punch. They were jealous because they didn't get there. So Jesus sits them down and he has a conversation. Now, perhaps I should have entitled this point not how to serve, but how not to serve, right? But do we see this request of verse 37? And do we see the jealousy of verse 41? And how many of us honestly would say, what knuckleheads? That's our reaction. What knuckleheads? What's wrong with these disciples? How can they not see it? And when I ask that, and I do, and I react that way, it only shows that I'm just like them. That I tend to be blind, and I think too much here instead of in another kingdom and in an upside-down view. You see, and let me see if I can press into that for you to illustrate, and I'm going to use several. But how many of you have ever, you don't have to raise your hands for this one because you won't like it. How many of you have ever worried? I mean, really worried. And we all know, don't we, that when we do that, it's because we don't believe the cross. We don't believe that something going wrong, horribly wrong, could ever be in God's provision and his plan. See, we've got figured out in our head, don't we, the way life is supposed to fall in place and do. And God, he's just not getting it right now. And there's a sense in which, I'm not saying every time, but there's a sense in which what we're saying when we worry is, God's not in control. I know what should be done, and he's not doing that. We've forgotten that our world is a broken, broken world in desperate need of redemption, of being ransomed back. Let me give another one. So, for instance, when we come to the church, we can tend to come in and think that, you know, the reason that we have a pastor and staff is to take care of us. And there's a sense in which, again, that's true, but when we put too much there, can't we? Then we're just hiring people to care for us. We're thinking that it's about me. But look at what verse 43 and 44 says. Not so with you. Don't be like those who rule over the Gentiles. No, not so with you. Instead, if you want to be great, if you want the left-hand seat and the right-hand seat, and we all do when we really step back and look at it, we want things. We want to have an awesome life. If you want that, he says, serve. If you want to be first, then be slave of all. It's an upside-down kingdom. It's upside-down stuff that he calls us to. But we slide into thinking that life is about our preferences rather than our sacrifice. That's our innate way to go. We think about that it would be about our preferences rather than us being people of sacrifice. We come asking what we will get. He calls us to see what we can give. We look for other people to meet our needs. He's looking to empower people to meet other people's needs. Now, I want to stop right there, and I want to say to you, I keep looking around at our congregation, and I watch what you do, and I am so encouraged at how many of you are sacrificing and serving and giving and giving and giving. And I'm so encouraged by that. And I want to tell you, don't grow weary in well-doing. Because we look around, do we not? And when we do that and we say, when are these people going to wake up? When are they going to come and really get serious about their walk with Christ? We've been doing this and this and this for them, and they still are sort of out there. That's God's territory. Leave it with Him. He called us to be a slave, and a slave doesn't ask when or how. Keep serving. You're doing a great job. Many of you are. And keep after that. Keep choosing to do that. So how do we serve? Out of a deep sense of gratitude that I have been so radically ransomed that I can live in a life of self-sacrifice. If we serve, we give, we work here in the church or anywhere so that we can get, then we've done just like the disciples. We've been looking for political or power or even our own comfort of positions. But what we're really looking to do is to serving in a spring forth because I have been so transformed. I'm so utterly grateful that I can do this out of gratitude to the one who paid it all for me. I can just do it because I want to say thanks to the one who died for me. So, how do we serve? Well, I think we've partly answered that, but let's go on even more to what is the point of serving? Why would we do this? What is the point of serving? So the story really of blind Bartimaeus really retells what we've just been looking at. You see, Jesus says he has to die, and the disciples, not just the disciples, but notice verse 48. What do the crowds believe about who Jesus is supposed to be? Because what do they do with blind Bartimaeus who calls out and says, Son of David, have mercy on me. What do they tell him to do? Be quiet. What are they thinking? Why would they tell him to be quiet when he's wanting mercy? Well, because he's the big king, and he's going into the city, and he's going to be the big dog. Don't bother him right now, because he's about to become the king on a throne. That's what they're thinking. And so they want to keep the riffraff away. And they say, no, don't come. Don't call out to him. But he says, come here. Come here to that beggar. Remember what he just said to the disciples? And now he is demonstrating, if you want to be great, be the servant of the lowest person. And this lowest person, a beggar sitting along the road, he calls to himself. If you want to be first, then be the slave of all. Why? So we can get? No. So we can look good? Certainly not. So God will like us? No. Verse 51. I really want you to park with me for a couple of minutes at verse 51. And will you please just let it walk in to the depths of your heart? Because there's this question here. I mean, just think about it. A guy sitting blind along the road and he's begging because he's blind, right? And Jesus finally calls him to himself, finally from his perspective, but he calls him to himself. And then, what does Jesus say to him? Have you ever thought about that? What do you want me to do for you? It's kind of like, well, maybe I came to the wrong guy. Did you notice that I'm blind? That's the way I used to look at it. But what I really need to see is that right now Jesus wants to ask me, and I think he wants to ask you, what do you want me to do for you right now? What do you want me to do for you? And I think our answer should be what Bartimaeus said. I want to see. I want to see my selfishness and die to it. I want to see my self-centeredness. Because we looked at those disciples and we thought, what lunkheads, but it's because we're blind to our own self-centeredness that we're like that. I want to see my blindness to these things. Now, let me press into that verse with you a little bit. The Apostle Paul was the champion of many things, but one thing he was a champion of, and he wrote over and over very carefully, was that Paul championed the all-sufficiency of Christ's sacrifice, that his sacrifice was sufficient to cover all of your needs, that that cross accounted for everything that was necessary in your life. So how do you explain Colossians 1:24? Now, I rejoice in what I was suffering for you, and I fill up in my flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, which is the church. Now, let me highlight for you a portion there. Notice what it says. What is still lacking? This is the guy, this is the apostle who God used to tell about the all-sufficiency of Christ's sacrifice, and he's saying that my suffering is filling up what is lacking in Christ's sacrifice. What could possibly be lacking in Christ's sacrifice? Is he saying, after saying so many times that the cross is all-sufficient, that that sacrifice wasn't sufficient? Did he say that Jesus didn't suffer enough? Was he saying that there wasn't enough sacrifice there? What was he saying? Why was Paul believing that he was filling up something that was a lack? Here's what it is. That your neighbor needs to see that same sacrifice. Your family needs to see you being a person of sacrifice. Those coworkers need to know that you live by sacrifice. You're in an upside-down kingdom. That's what he was saying. It isn't that it was lacking that Christ's sacrifice isn't sufficient. It is that in me, it now can be displayed to others around me. So what is the point of serving? The point of serving is this, that Jesus and his sacrifice is seen again and again and again in me, in you. That's why we serve. That's why we give. That's why we sacrifice. So let me see if I can get real practical now. This is the point where you draw in your toes. We've talked about, for example, reading our Bibles regularly. Have you been seeing that increase? We've been talking about looking at having family devotions, about giving sacrificially, financially. We've been talking about praying and praying together. Are we seeing these increase? Because our numbers really have a lot of room for growth. When we ask, how are we doing at these things? And we're not trying to do it out of a sense of guilt. We're trying to do it is to say, are we really becoming followers of Jesus Christ? And he said, I will be a servant to all. I will be the slave. I will be the one to pick up the basin and towel. I will be the one to go to the cross. Are we changing? Are we doing these things? They're small things. I get that. But if we're not willing to do those, don't you understand that what we're saying is, I'm not willing to die to myself, even for that, even for those amount of things. You see, the only way that we're going to put on those things is if we suffer, if we die. I know it isn't a big suffering. It isn't like being whipped, and I get that. But if we won't even do that, if we're somehow more interested in our self-comfort and our self-love and our self-seeking, you know, I want to be seated in the place of honor. We saw how crazy that was. But what we're saying is, I don't have time to read my Bible, but I do have time to watch a football game. Folks, that's just crazy. That's just crazy. How can I do that? And so if someone comes here week after week and still does not allow the Spirit of God to be changing them from within, that person is believing something other than the gospel. That person still thinks, like the disciples, that what God's supposed to do is just sort of strike us with a magic wand and make us the way he's supposed to make us, and we don't engage that. And that's not true. That's not the gospel. It is about us self-sacrificing for other people. If loving service is not a significant means of Christ-likeness in your view, what have you been listening to? Where are you understanding? And again, I want to say, many of you understand that, and you're doing well, and I get that. But some of us, we're not picking up those Bibles. We're not praying. We're not having conversations with unchurched. We're not really looking to see what it means to die to our own self-interests and to live to others. And I want to work at that. So can you point today to demonstrating Christ-like sacrifice, because love is all about self-sacrifice? What significant means of service, being a slave, has Jesus' ransom taken you to? How are you winning the battle over selfishness to become a servant? For example, again, we're having this whose birthday is it opportunity. We're not saying it's the only way to go, but what we want to continue to do is offer us easy ways, pathways and roads to be able to say, how can I put on the values and the person of Christ? And these are practical ways that we can do that. So today, are you at least sometime in the midst of this Christmas season going to sit down and have a conversation, maybe like a conversation you have never had before, and it will be the most awkward conversation you've had to lead in your household in a long time, but say, how do we make Christ central in our lives? And for some of you, that will be a normal just keeping walking this walk. For some of you, that will be radical. Do it. Do it. Be a servant. Be someone who looks to not come to be served, but to serve and to give your life for others. Let's pray.